Welcome to the Herpetile Podcast. My name is Nash and I love herpetology. This podcast explores all things to do with reptiles and amphibians. I hope you like it. Welcome to the show. My name is Nash. I'm the host of the Herpetile Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Amanda Duffus. She is an infectious disease biologist and works mostly in rhinovirus biology, which she has been researching since 2004. She is also interested in Amanda researching emerging infectious diseases in herpetofauna and amphibian natural history. Amanda is an award-winning educator and faculty member at Gordon State College. I hope I said all that right. I think I said some things wrong.
You did really good.
Welcome to my show.
Well, thank you for having me.
My first question is, how and when did you first become interested in working with animals?
Well, I actually started out going to uni for virology, which is kind of funny since I fell into working with viruses later on. But I actually started out as a pre-medical student in life sciences, and I was very interested in viruses. But what happened was I actually hurt my back when I was 18, and I switched majors into... Sorry, Nash, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, yeah.
Okay, sorry. And I hurt my back, so I had to have some surgery, and I fell in love with ecology and evolution in my biology class. So I switched majors over to biology, and I started getting really, really interested in herps, specifically salamanders, and I thought I wanted to work with them a little more. And then when I was finishing up my first degree, I couldn't find anybody who would let me work with salamanders, so I settled for any amphibian. And I was really, really lucky. I ended up at Trent University studying rhinoviruses in amphibians under Michael Barrell.
Yeah. Can you tell us what rhinoviruses are? Because you do a bit of work on rhinoviruses, right?
Yes, sir. Rhinoviruses are really interesting viruses. They're from the viral family Iridoviridae, which just means that they are double-stranded DNA viruses, meaning they have just a typical double helix of DNA as their genetic material, and they're very cool viruses. What's really cool about the rhinoviruses in particular is that they can affect frogs, fish, and reptiles. So you can say you get a frog infected with frog virus 3, it can transmit that to a turtle and vice versa.
So only herps, sort of?
No, there are other iridoviruses that actually affect insects. The reason why they're called iridoviruses is because the first ones were isolated from insects and they make them iridescent colors.
Oh, wow. Are there any other viruses that that properly affect amphibians or reptiles?
Oh, yes. There's lots of viruses, actually. There's herpes viruses. There are a bunch of unclassified viruses. Yeah, it's always like that with the lower vertebrates. There's a whole group of people who just study the lower vertebrate viruses, and it's kind of neat.
Yeah, that'd be work to do.
Yeah, but they're very fascinating. I've done a little research, not ever in the field, on herpes viruses, but I do know that they affect... turtles and other reptiles and amphibians. I don't think the viruses can jump taxa, but I'm not sure. I don't know if anybody's actually investigated that or not.
What would they do to the animal?
The rhinoviruses, it really depends on the species. A lot of the time when you get a rhinovirus infection and say, let's pull a very typical ranid North American ranid, like the wood frog.
Yeah.
Its tadpoles typically get ulcerations, so they look like they've got big bruises on their bellies,
mm-hmm.
and they'll hemorrhage.
Would it die? Sorry, I interrupted you, but
No worries. In wood frogs and ranid frogs, depending on the species, it can have very, very high mortality rates, up to 100% of some of the tadpoles. In England, where I did my PhD work with Trent Garner and Richard Nichols, still looking at ranaviruses, in common frogs, so in Rana temporaria, the adults are the ones that typically get the ranavirosis and die. So they get internal hemorrhages, or they get really skinny with ulcers and losing fingers and toes and stuff like that.
So one of those frogs, the tadpoles died, and the other one, the adults died. Could it be like vice versa? So the one where the adults died, could the tadpoles die?
There's not a lot of evidence in North America for adult wood frogs getting the disease.
Yeah.
Or testing positive for ranavirus DNA. And in England, it's the exact opposite. The tadpoles seem to be very disease or infection free. And it's the adults that get hit the hardest by ranaviruses.
So are those the two main species you study on ranaviruses or ranaviruses? Or do you have a main species?
In Canada, I did work primarily with wood frogs and what else did I do it on? And some of the salamander larvae and some of the tree frogs,
mm-hmm.
like gray tree frogs and spring peepers and stuff like that. But we didn't have time to do a lot of experiments with them. So I did experiments on wood frogs in Canada. And then in England, there's not a lot of species diversity, but the herps there are really neat. I did some big experiments on the tadpoles and collected a lot of dead adults and analyzed them for ranavirus infection.
So you did a paper recently with my past guest Steve Elaine about emerging infectious diseases in European herpetofauna, I think.
Yep.
And I heard something about the, well, I might not have gotten it right, but I read something about the 1990s and ranaviruses. So was it that they were only discovered in the 1990s?
Well, actually, ranaviruses were first described in captive leopard frogs in North America in the mid-1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the late 1980s and early 1990s when they started appearing in wild and captive populations. One of the first reports of ranavirus in captive frogs actually happens in Australia by Spear and Smith in 1992.
Is it, so then is it a worldwide disease?
Yeah. The virus is found worldwide. It's got a very extensive range now. It's found on every continent except for Australia. It's even been found in Africa, in Madagascar, and in Cameroon.
So it's like a herp pandemic like we've got.
Yeah, it's like it's a herp pandemic similar to chytrid fungus, but not as well known.
Mm-hmm. So what made you become interested in working with ranaviruses specifically in amphibians?
Well, as I said a little earlier, I kind of got lucky with hitting a jackpot with my master's degrees, where I got to work with two things I was very interested in.
Mm.
And it just was a spark in me, and for the last getting on 16, 17 years, I've been really fortunate to study something that I'm excited about, that I'm always learning new things about, and working with some really great people like Steve has really made a big difference.
So, when you were first wanting to study viruses in humans, did you ever think that you'd be studying them in herps, or did you even like know much about herps or anything?
I've always liked frogs, and my parents actually have a picture of me at our cottage, when I'd collected a bunch of leopard frogs and they got out all over the cabin. It's called the frog fiasco in the picture album at my parents' camp. So I've always liked wildlife. I've always been outside, but I kind of more envisioned myself working in a lab, a level four lab, and stuff like that. I never dreamed that I could combine the lab and the outside, and now my students all together like that.
How are rhinoviruses transmitted? Would it just be a frog and a turtle being near each other, or maybe a turtle eating a frog?
It can happen both those ways, actually. It can be transmitted through direct contact, through one eating through oh gosh, what's the word I'm looking for? Through necrophagy and all sorts of stuff like that. But it can be just the virus floating in the water, and a frog can pick it up, or a turtle floating in the turtle floating in the water. Bad analogy, or the virus floating in the water and the turtle gets sick from that as well. So it's there's a lot of different ways you can get rhinovirus.
You also study the phylogenetics of rhinoviruses. Can you explain a bit about them?
Okay, so what I've been interested in specifically is there are about 24 genes that make up the iridovirus core set. So that's something that every iridovirus has. And it's primarily conserved genes that are involved in viral replication. Some are involved in virulence, and others are involved in entry and exit into the host cell. So it's all about their processing and becoming an infected variant in the next generation.
Yeah, 'cause how I thought phylogenetics worked was I thought phylogenetics were more studying evolution and how animals would have like convergent evolution or things like that.
Yeah, what I'm looking at with those 26 core genes is which ones make the best phylogenetic trees. So which ones tell us the best relationships, evolutionarily speaking, that we can use to make inferences on a larger scale. So what single gene or what couple of genes can we put together that represent the whole rhinovirus tree?
So then, how would you like see the genes or know what genes they have?
Well, luckily for me, a lot of people have already done that. So what I do is I go on the there's a database called GenBank where people upload their full sequences that are annotated, so you already know where the genes are on them.
But just asking, is GenBank public or for research only?
Oh yeah. No, GenBank is public. You can type in GenBank into your Google bar, and you can search all sorts of different rhinovirus sequences, iridovirus sequences. There's human genes. You name it. It's a big public
That
database.
sounds interesting. So have you found anything big or very interesting, or figured out the line of genes for rhinoviruses?
Well, we've been looking at that, and we have an article in review that my students have really spent the last 6 years working on, showing us that there are a couple or there's about three or four genes that will make really good
Yeah.
trees. And I can't remember which genes they are off the top of my head. But I think that that's kind of irrelevant because it'd be very boring molecular biology.
So, can you tell us more about the paper you did with Steve Elaine?
It was a pleasure working with Steve to write that manuscript. He focused his work on BD and B Sal, and I kind of focused on the viruses. So I did some very interesting research on herpes viruses, which was kind of cool, and I learned a lot about them. It's because we focused in Europe. Herpes viruses are actually a little bit better described in European amphibians than they are in North American amphibians. And of course, I did the rhinovirus section because it's always a pleasure for me to dig back into that literature and learn all about the new stuff that's been published since I finished my PhD about 10 years ago now.
Do you still publish anything to do with coronaviruses?
I still work on rhinoviruses regularly. I wish I could do more. I'm at a teaching school, so everything I do has to necessarily, and it's a pleasure to involve students in. We're actually starting a turtle health program that's going to look at a bunch of emerging viruses, including rhinoviruses, in our pond on campus where we have some aquatic turtles.
So, do you think all these diseases are contributing to extinction?
Oh, definitely. We even get, disease spillover from common frogs. Rhinovirus spilled over into common toads, and there once just because one species is affected negatively doesn't necessarily mean that everything else in the pond is going to get off scot-free either.
Then, do you have a favorite amphibian species?
Well, I must admit, I am very partial to Australian green tree frogs.
Do you keep any of them?
Yes, I actually have one in Canada that my parents call their grand frog. He's almost 20.
Do you keep any other animals?
Well, I have four cats, and I've got two more dumpy tree frogs in the US with me, and I've got a couple of Pac-Man frogs. And I've had an assortment of other creatures.
I've never seen a Pac-Man frog. Do they look like Pac-Man or something?
They have really, really huge mouths, and basically anything that can fit in it, they'll eat it. So kind of like a green tree frog. But
Oh, you can go.
these ones are from South America, sorry.
Oh no, you can go. So if you could tell everyone in the world something about reptiles or amphibians, what would it be?
They're very important in our environment. Just because they're not warm and fuzzy doesn't mean they're not important and worth saving.
So, is that about amphibians or reptiles or just both?
Just both. I think they're undervalued for what they contribute to our
Yeah,
ecosystems.
it's sometimes weird or annoying when you meet someone that just like acts really scared about them, and so my final question for you today is, what is an unusual fact about reptiles or amphibians that people might not know?
Well, one that's really cool and one of my favorite factoids is that wood frogs, or Lithobates sylvaticus, or used to be known as Rana sylvatica, can actually freeze solid
Wow.
because they have cryoprotectants in their blood that their liver produces.
Yeah, so are they the only frogs that freeze solid? Because I know most frogs freeze over the winter, but
Yeah, these guys will freeze solid. Then gray tree frogs, they can freeze up to, I think, 65% of their body. And then the other ones have to be a bit more
does
careful.
that have an impact on their health compared to other frogs?
I'm not actually sure. I think there is some work examining that right now going on. I'm not 100% sure.
Anything else you want to say?
No, thank you very much for having me on your podcast. I appreciate it. It's always nice to see someone who's so interested in amphibians and
Thanks for
reptiles.
coming on the show, Amanda.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Thanks. See you next time. Thanks for listening to the Herpetile Podcast. Please subscribe so you don't miss out on any of the latest episodes. Happy herping!